Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Paul.
Hello, welcome to Canter. Today we've got Scott and Adam. Paul's having a rest today. And joining us on the line is Brad Hutchinson from New Zealand. How are you going, Brad?
Hey, yeah, good, thanks. How are you, lads?
Yeah, well, thanks, mate. Thank you for joining us. Now, Brad, you work for, well, you founded a company, I believe, you're called Southern Hemisphere Botanicals?
Yeah, that's right. Probably maybe four years ago, I applied for a license to license for research and breeding industrial hemp in New Zealand. So received that and then, started on this particular journey with Southern Hemisphere Botanicals.
Very cool. I think with the way the world's at the moment, I think a lot of eyes are on New Zealand. So it's quite a fascinating location to discuss, and you're our first Kiwi guest to have on board. So thank you very much for helping enlighten us on what's going on over there, man.
Awesome. Yeah, no, thanks for having me. And hopefully I can give you guys a bit of an insight into what's happening here in NZ.
Very cool. So you say you applied for a license 4 years ago. Has hemp been something that's been open in New Zealand for a long period of time?
I think it was going back to about around 2001 from memory, a few guys formed a hemp industry association, Steve Burnett being one of them. They had to lobby the government, Ministry of Health, for a couple of years there. I can't quite remember the history there. It was quite fascinating. So it started off fairly slow, and it was really the last probably two to three years where it's really gained momentum when the new law came in here in New Zealand to allow for hemp seed to be legally sold as a food. A lot of interest sort of developed in the sector. So a lot of farmers and just enthusiasts went about getting their general licenses. And I couldn't tell you the amount of acreage it's been growing now, but at the moment, but there's a lot of license holders here.
Was it a difficult process?
Not particularly. I don't know what it's like compared to Australia. It was obviously a police check was probably the what took the longest, and then it was just a fair bit of compliance stuff, mapping out exactly where you're going to be growing. The hardest thing was sourcing the hemp cultivar. Here in New Zealand, we've got a list of government-approved cultivars that we choose from. And that seed was really tightly held by farmers that were already in the game. So that was actually the biggest bottleneck. So getting the licenses, obviously just going through your compliance checks, et cetera, was a little bit tricky there, a bit of paperwork involved. But once you get that, it was trying to get the seed. I think it's now that more farmers have come on board now, there's a little bit more open source seed on the market available there, so it could be a little bit easier for farmers now, I would like to think anyway.
So with the list that you speak of, with the limited list of cultivars, were they all domestic cultivars, or were you able to access international providers?
That's quite an interesting question, really, because it's, when you say domestic cultivars, I guess, they had been grown domestically, but they had been at some point imported into New Zealand. Our main, probably most popular cultivar here in New Zealand is Kompolti, and that's originally from Hungary. That made its way into Australia, I believe, through Andrew Catalaris. And then that was brought into New Zealand by Steve Burnett in the early 2000s. And it's a really nice cultivar, actually. It's got a really nice terpene profile. a good yielder, and it seems to thrive in the conditions here in New Zealand. So that was the main one. The other ones, you had your USO 31s and your Finolas, et cetera, your continental or Western European varieties that were growing here. I'm not too sure the uptake of those, to be honest, from the other farmers, but yeah.
So
Poldy was a nice one.
Is there with the bioconservation laws, does New Zealand have fairly stringent biocon laws for bringing seed in?
They do. Being an island, everything's fairly strict here coming into it. I don't know what it's like compared to Australia again, but I know, for example, our phytosanitary certification requirements mm-hmm. are exactly the same as Australia. So we follow that. With Australia. For me, when I first came into the industry, I saw that there was a bottleneck with genetics. Like I said, they were being tightly held by some farmers. There were sort of non-cultivation contracts tied into sourcing seed here, I didn't like that. So I looked elsewhere and I ended up importing seed from China, actually. Industrial hemp seed there, so that's been really interesting playing around with that.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating, isn't it? You don't hear China mentioned a lot in the industry, so that's cool.
No, you have all these, there's a whole bunch of people over the last few decades and still to this day going around collecting landrace varieties from obviously your most common places like Afghanistan and India, Pakistan and Africa, but you don't really hear too much about the Chinese varieties, but there's some real interesting stuff there. The Chinese varieties, just in my experience, I'm talking about the Yunnan land races there, seem to be have a bit of certain compounds there, like, fairly high CBG. They're very vigorous, really interesting terpene profiles there as well. There is some interesting stuff to be sifted through there if you can get the seed in and grow it legally.
Yeah, cool. I've seen that you've used this Yunnan strain to actually for winter growing. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's kind of a bit of a pipe dream of mine here in like where I'm situated in the central North Island. We're fairly mild climate here. We're looking at about probably 27 degrees on an average day in summer. Winter we might get down to 17 or 18 degrees. So with that particular cultivar, it's a long flowering cultivar. And the first time I grew it out here, I ended up, I think it was about 1st of June that I ended up harvesting it. Flowering at Easter, which is traditionally when outdoor growers are harvesting. So, yeah, it was quite interesting. So I thought, there might be something in there. We might be able to do a bit of a autumn crop there. So it is something I'm playing around with. I do find that growing for seed, the seed just didn't really seem to, like it appeared to mature. But when we tried to germinate from it, it just didn't have a very good germination rate. So, it could handle the cold temperatures, no problem. Even the frosts we were getting at that time didn't bother. It had really good mold resistance, which is another, seems to be a good characteristic of these Chinese and Southeast Asian varieties. So, I'll persevere with it. It's just a self-indulgent project for me, really, and we'll see what that comes to.
So with the growth characteristics of it, is it like a short squat plant or does it reach? What's the growth characteristics?
They go pretty tall. If you grow them closely spaced, they'll just reach for the skies. I mean, I've seen photos of 5 or 6 meter plants. Some of those Yunnan varieties. Yeah, it's crazy. You can see on my Instagram photo there, I've got standing.
Yeah,
in front of
I think
it.
I've seen that one. That's
fairly tall
have
ones.
To be
there.
5 meters at least.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty big, but I mean, I've seen photos of people standing in ones that are even taller. So it's quite cool seeing them grow like that. And they're so because they have been bred for fiber as well. In China, they seem to have some very strong you know, stalks and root systems there, so they can sort of tolerate being that tall and not snapping. So, sure. Yeah, quite interesting.
So with your hemp licenses over there, are they broken down? So some people have a license for fibre, some for seed, some for producing cannabinoids, or is it just one sort of license?
So really there's two probably classes of licenses here. You've got your general license, so that allows you to grow a government-approved cultivar, so something off the list there, to be below 0.3% THC. Then you've got your research and breeding license, which allows you to grow a non-approved cultivar, and that's you're allowed to grow up to 0.5% THC on that one.
Sure.
But there's no – we're not allowed to breed for cannabinoids. We're not allowed to extract the flower material from the plant. At the end of harvest, the flower, the biomass needs to be composted or incinerated. So, yeah, obviously that there is a few restrictions on what we can do there.
It's a bit of a frustrating part of hemp farming globally, I think, that there's such a waste of biomass. I think it's quite frustrating to a lot of farmers.
It is. It's a massive waste. I mean, when us hemp growers, we can see the value in the biomass.
Yeah.
So it is frustrating. But, you know, the good thing is it does make a superb mulch. You know, a very expensive mulch when you look at the value that could be added to it if we were allowed to work with it. But, hey, it is what it is.
So, Brad, I've seen you've done soil testing. I'd just like to know how you go about it.
Go about the soil testing. Well, there's a couple of laboratories here in NZ that we can send our samples away to, if that's what you're asking.
Yep.
Hills Laboratory up in Hamilton, I think now. Yeah, we'll just send samples away to them once a year, maybe twice if budget allows.
I don't think we've covered this before on our show, but what sort of depth are you taking those samples from?
15 centimeters,
yep,
is the standard depth.
And your natural soils out there, are they like a loamy soil or?
It varies a lot in my area. My property's like straight clay soil. It's not ideal. There's a lot of work has to go into building the soil up for myself, adding organic matter into it, balancing the minerals. Where I'm licensed to grow, it's quite a loamy soil. So, that's been a real pleasure to work with in that particular part there.
Yeah, very cool. So minimal amendments out there, you're not adding gypsum or anything like that to break it down?
Well, yeah, I do really, because it was it had been fairly well, I wouldn't say abused, but just hadn't been looked after. I'd say it never would have had a soil test in its life. Sure. My little patch of ground on that farm, probably the odd little bit of dolomite lime added to it over the years, which is what farmers tend to do here in New Zealand, adding extra magnesium into their soil when it was completely probably unnecessary and probably the opposite of what they need to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wasn't, you know, the soil, these nice loamy soils appear to be in really good condition, but, you know, when you actually get a soil test done on them, it's it can be quite surprising at just how out of balance the mineral content is there.
Yeah, that's interesting. And what about pH? Is the pH something that's a major concern there, or is it relatively
neutral? It is really, because New Zealand soils are known to have a low pH. I can't quite remember the exact reason for that. So, there is a lot of lime that needs to be added to New Zealand soils.
Yeah, interesting. That's interesting. So I've read something about the New Zealand UV spectrum, and over there you guys consider it one of your weapons. So can you just explain how the UV light there differs from, say, an equatorial country, and what sort of benefits you would get from it?
It is interesting here, because I don't know if you guys have ever been out to NZ on for a holiday here in summer, but
not myself.
When you're here in New Zealand, like you get sunburn and you know it.
Yeah, okay.
It's a different kind of sunburn out here. You can actually feel your skin sizzling. So yeah, I've lived out in Europe, Oregon, and spent summers out there, and like you can just walk around topless or a singlet all day and not have to worry about putting sunscreen on, really. So there is something here. Apparently our UVB spectrum here is a lot higher than the rest of the world. I don't know if it's still to do with the hole in the ozone layer here.
I heard that that's really closed up.
But, you know, they talk about... Yeah, well, that's what I read as well. I mean, who knows what to believe these days? There's so much misinformation on
the
news and the internet, isn't there? So you just don't know. But I had read that. I can still tell you from experience that the sunburn is just as bad, if not worse, every summer.
Yeah.
But the whole, going back to your initial question there, they're all, you know, seems to be a lot of native plants here that do have medicinal properties. So I don't really want to get into an argument about it, but when you look at your tea tree varieties, you know, I think Australia got 130 and we got two, Kānuka and Mānuka. You know, Mānuka is fairly well known now for having some very good antibacterial and other medicinal properties, and so does Kānuka. You know, a lot of those, have most tea tree varieties having become established here and evolved in New Zealand, I guess something to do with creating secondary metabolites that can probably deal with that UVB spectrum. Mm-hmm. So how that correlates with cannabis or hemp, there is anecdotal evidence to say that New Zealand, sort of heritage New Zealand cannabis varieties have developed higher cannabinoid content. Obviously because it's been illicit, there hasn't been a lot of research work done on it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence to a lot of backpackers from around the world will tell you that the weed here in New Zealand is stronger than anywhere else in the world. They might say that to every person they meet from any country they go into, who knows, but... now that legalization's opening up here, we can probably start to do a little bit more research on that. So, watch your space.
Yeah, it's quite exciting, isn't it? I mean, you guys are developing at a rapid rate. Just before we touch on the upcoming referendum, you mentioned that you've spent time in Oregon and Europe. Oregon's a fascinating place to me. Can you tell me what you're doing out there, what it was all about, and how the scene looks, what's going on?
Yeah, it is so fascinating. I've been out to the States a few times over the years, but I went out to Oregon last year and spent some time out there assisting in developing a 20-acre farm to grow hemp flower for the smoking market there. I followed the progress in Oregon for quite a long time because I think it's been legal there for about probably 14, 15 years.
Yep.
And it's quite an interesting state, really. They seem to have created legislation that doesn't really allow for big corporates to come in and take over. It's, you know, very much they're all about the sort of a craft boutique industry there.
That's good.
Which is what I'm all about too. So when I went out there last year, I arrived there at the start of, well, just before the start of the season, and it was crazy. It was, there was some legislation. Well, you know, things are all constantly changing over in the States, but there was some legislation there that allowed hemp farmers to grow and extract and sell biomass off a hemp license. And it was sort of like the gold rush, really. I saw farmers out there that were just ripping out some, you know, whatever other crops they had in there and planting out hemp on a big scale. So yeah, it was quite nuts.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. And the culture there of the general population seems a bit more accepting than other places, to me anyway, at face value.
Yeah, well, Oregonians just seem so chilled. Like they, and I guess they've had long enough now to get used to recreational cannabis in the legal industry. So, you know, it's not too big a deal for them. Where I was down in the south of Oregon, you could drive out into the rural areas, and from the highway you could see into people's backyards or front yards and see their personal grows. So I think they're allowed to grow 4 plants per person and up to about 12 per household, I believe. I could be wrong on that or something like that. But, you know, you can actually see them from time to time sort of being grown in the on their property. So it was just quite interesting seeing that. And it just seems so normal. You know, there's nothing particularly exciting about it. It's just a bloody tomato plant to them, really.
Yeah, yeah. So the stigma that we feel around the world, particularly in the Western nations, you just don't feel that over there. Is that correct?
Yeah, I didn't anyway.
Yeah, that's cool. Very cool. And do they have like medicinal licenses where a grower can grow for a set number of patients and maybe have a 90 plant or 100 plant grow on their domestic premises?
I could have this wrong. I don't think they do have that where they nominate patients. I could be wrong because I did see some properties that had more than 12 plants. Yeah. So actually, come to think of it, I think, yeah, that could be a law. I might check up on that because that could be the case there. But there was just so many different size grows there. You know, you could see some large indoor facilities, really large greenhouse facilities, and then you just had, like, for where I was, we had 20 acres of that was just mainly hemp where we were, but say looking over at the neighbours there, they had, yeah, they probably had 25 plants. So I would like to think they probably had maybe what you're saying, nominated patients they were growing for, or maybe they just had stacked people inside the property that all held a license to grow a couple each. I'm not too sure there. So.
Yeah, sure. That's interesting. And it must be nice to see, I mean, you guys in New Zealand, with the rate you're developing, I guess it's a bit of a look into the future for you guys. Maybe not exactly the way things will be rolled out in New Zealand, but it must be nice to feel that, you know, in the near future, hopefully you can experience some of this freedom.
Oh, definitely, man. Really, we don't know how it's going to look in 5 years' time here in New Zealand. I think it is evolving rapidly here, but it was a very slow start. Considering, you know, Kiwis are fairly forward-thinking on a lot of topics for some reason, and we were very slow on this one. It's been, I mean, they talk about that being a bit of a benefit to us because the people down at Medicines Control at the Ministry of Health were able to travel around the world, go to Canada, California, Australia, and just look at legislation in these other territories and probably improve, pick and choose a little bit what they thought was working, what wasn't. So I guess, you know, in 20 years' time, when hopefully the plant's legal everywhere, we'll probably look back at it and the slow start New Zealand got off to may not be a hindrance at all. You know, it might have been a bit of an advantage, but that remains to be seen.
I agree with that. I think, you know, when there's the pioneers are always sort of learning on the go, and I think it's great that the sort of next people to get on board can improve on some of the deficits of the programs, the agronomic practices, the legislation, further improve on it and set the stage for the future. So what's going on with
pioneers get the arrows, the settlers get the gold.
Yeah, that's about right. Yes, that was cool anecdote. So you've got a referendum coming up. Can you tell our listeners what's going on, what the referendum's about, what people will be voting for? Because here in Australia, that seems a reasonable way off. And you guys have sort of snuck up behind us and all of a sudden, bang, in a couple of months, you'll be voting.
Yeah, well, I mean, now, so medical came in on April the 1st here. It is still evolving slowly. It'll be a fairly slow process to get that off the ground as people are just, you know, getting into position for that. It's going to be a lot quicker. Talking about the medical, that'll be a lot quicker than I think Australia, where I don't know how many licenses have been given out in Australia now. It was last time I looked, it was below 30. It was fairly slow the first couple of years as it evolved in Australia. But, you know, everyone's starting to come out of the woodwork here in New Zealand now, and everyone wants to grow it. So the Ministry of Health are going to be absolutely inundated with license applications. So, yeah, that's medical. Well, recreational, we get to vote on that in September when we have our next national elections. And we're really just voting on a framework at this stage. The government haven't put too much energy into actually writing out a whole set of regulations. It is just a very basic framework. Some of the more interesting points when you look at it are can't grow THC. So you can't buy THC over 15%. Mm. Or you can't buy flower with over 15% THC content. The other one I really like is you can't not one company cannot grow more than 20% of the market share.
Yeah, so, that's beautiful.
So they are really trying to put in a few checks and balances to create a little bit of a more of a craft industry here, or just try and stop a couple of the big corporates from coming and taking over. Whether that actually works in practice, well, that remains to be seen as well. We've got to get the recreational vote over the line first.
Yeah, exactly. What's the polling looking like? Is it pretty positive for the pro side?
Every time they release a new poll every week at the moment, a newspaper or a news organisation's done one or a company's done one, and it just changes. It's 51% one week, 51% the other way, the other week, or whatever. It's just so close.
Oh, right, it's that close.
No one can call it at the moment. Mm. Yeah, and it really, like if you talk to people, individual Kiwis here, they've all got their own opinion because they might hang out in a circle of non-users who none of those people are interested in voting. So as far as they're concerned, it's not going to pass.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then vice versa as well. So it's just too tight to call. I've really got no idea. The interesting thing is it's a non-binding referendum, so the government doesn't have to actually obey the people's wishes on this one. And that's probably not a bad thing because, I think if Labor get back in and it's a close vote but it fails, they can actually still bring it in, which I really believe that they're likely to do, especially after all this COVID-19 stuff. You know, they want to create industry and jobs here in New Zealand, and you know, what's the better way to do it? There's a whole industry
ready to
staring in the face, ready to kick off. Exactly, yeah. Man. So, cool. Interesting times.
Very interesting. So, do you find that public education on the topic, on the debate, is it prominent? Are people getting access to the information they need to make a educated decision?
That's a really good question. I believe that the government were allotting some funding to exactly that, so that the people did know what they were voting for. I'm starting to see a little bit roll out. The New Zealand Drug Foundation, who are funded by the government, they've come out with a fair bit of information about it. They're quite pro-cannabis legislation, so, you know, you have the opposition party supporters complaining about that they think that they're too biased.
Yeah.
I'm probably biased too, but, you know, in reality I would say they're biased, they're just researched.
Yeah.
The people that are against it are really still going off the old propaganda and, you know, generalisations that have been well and truly debunked.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think our whole journey of getting here to Canter and us boys getting a podcast, I think for me it sort of started with me not believing that there was true medicinal value and true therapeutic value in cannabis, and trying to read up about it to sort of argue for the against stance. And amongst all the reading I've done, I just find it's a very lopsided sort of debate. I think the people on the pro side that know their stuff just have that much ammunition for valuable like information and legit information, factual information. And it seems to be that they're arguing against people that are using misinformation for their argument.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's quite. It's
you
quite
know, for their own agenda as well. It's absolutely. Probably the people that are against it. It streaks the narrative not to actually do any research. But you know, it's really interesting to hear that how you have come into the space as well. And you know, applaud you for doing the research. I mean, how many people do you actually meet that have, you know, were anti it and have done the research and good research and then still remained anti it? You know, I mean, there are always negative aspects to anything.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you can, for example, if you eat too many bloody apples, you'll get sick, you know. So, you know, overindulgence in cannabis is, you know, it is a thing and it's something that we need to talk about, this harm minimization stuff.
Absolutely.
But the education is starting to get out there. Had you guys seen the, there's quite an interesting longitudinal study that has come out of Otago and Christchurch here in New Zealand, the universities there. Started in around about 1975, so it's been going for 40-odd years. And the study was a group of a couple of thousand babies, and they have sort of tracked them through their life into their 40s. And it's just it's all around sort of social and health outcomes for a select group or select population.
Sure.
And so obviously cannabis is something that's come into it as well, and even more so now. The people behind that study have actually started to release a little bit more information looking into cannabis use on this select population over 40 years. There's been some really interesting findings there. And it's actually the most data regarding cannabis use has come out of that study.
It's quite fascinating. I think so when you say they've measured babies, so they've measured that for the last 40 years. So now we're talking adults in our sort of age bracket. Do they link socioeconomic circumstance with cannabis usage?
Yeah, well, they didn't really. There is some work being done on that. I didn't look too much into that, to be honest. To that side of it. It was a little bit interesting because down in Otago and Christchurch, which is sort of the lower South Island, there is a more predominantly Pakeha or New Zealand European population there. Okay. There's less of a – it's not a great – you know, I don't know what the exact makeup of the population. It's a good sample size. It's probably – The people have said, you know, that there's probably not as many Māori in that study that there could have been to get a better indication of exact, socioeconomic impacts of cannabis use on Māori or Pacific Islanders in New Zealand.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, when you look at the statistics, like a lot of countries that, where minorities have sort of had, they've been impacted more by cannabis use when it comes to things such as crime. Statistically, police are probably more inclined. Well, it's hard to say it correctly, but you know, statistically, more Māori in New Zealand have been jailed for cannabis-related offences.
Sure.
And, you know, there may not be – I don't think it's the case that more Māori are using it. It's just they seem to get the sharp end of the stick when it comes to law enforcement on it.
Saying that you're not saying that you believe police consciously target these groups, but you're saying statistically it appears as though these groups do get a bit more focus on them. And that could be linked with higher numbers for that group?
Yeah, I mean, the statistics don't lie, and that's definitely the case. You know, I mean, I, I can't really say what the reasons are there. But the interesting thing is, in regards to that, is that the Ministry of Health they're also aware of that. So with this medical cannabis regime and the potentially the recreational one, they have actually put that they're giving priority to what we say iwi groups here. Iwi would be a sort of a tribal group here in New Zealand, a Māori tribal group. They're giving them a little bit more, I guess, priority to allow them to go for licensing as well. And I guess to try and negate the, you know, the negative socioeconomic impacts that statistically that they've had over the years.
Yeah, okay. That's fascinating. I've been reading a bit about this upcoming referendum, and you do mention that it's just a basic framework that they're sort of talking about, and it's not in any depth. You know, they haven't rolled out exactly how they want to go about it, but there's some fascinating points, and it seems like quite a responsible approach that you guys are looking at over there. So some of the interesting things that I certainly agree with is they're saying they definitely don't want younger people, you know, with developing brains consuming cannabis. They don't want to push them towards cannabis. So they're saying any items designed to appeal to the young will be banned. They're also saying 20 years or older will be an age limit for purchasing cannabis. So a couple of those things about protecting the young and those with form developing brains, I think they're quite responsible approaches. Then they're also talking about a limit potentially of 14 grams per day for someone to buy. I think it's a large amount to purchase on one day. People obviously aren't going to consume that in one day, and if they do, they're probably going to have some issues. But I think being able to buy a week's worth of cannabis or 2 weeks' worth of cannabis in one go is the more likely sort of course people will take. So the 14 grams sounds quite reasonable. They're also talking about starting off with just fresh dried cannabis being available, I guess products that have come from extracts or something like that are maybe looked at further down the track. So it all seems relatively well thought out. What are your thoughts on those sorts of policies?
That surprised me, actually, allowing the dried flower to be able to purchase that. I don't think we'd get that on medical. Obviously, on recreational, we would. Probably one of the topics that the anti-brigade keep bringing up is that the Ministry of Health declared that they would make New Zealand smoke-free, but I think it was 2023-ish. So they say, well, why would you allow consumers to purchase flower? Not realising that, of course, the Ministry will be pushing for probably vaporising of that flower. Yeah. So look to see plenty of different delivery systems coming out on the market as well, all around that. At the end of the day, look, I mean, I'm happy that they're allowing the raw or the dried flower to be sold, because it helps to create a little bit more of a craft boutique industry here as well.
Yeah, sure.
Consumers are going to, when they come in, as you've seen what happened in Canada, consumers given the choice between buying, you know, flower from a massive corporate greenhouse setup or buying from a smaller boutique facility, depending on, obviously it comes down to price, but, you know, quality-wise, you'd like to think the small boutique growers are going to have it.
Yeah.
So, I'm prepared for that. And at the end of the day, I mean, who are the people sitting up there in our beehive to tell us what we can and can't do with a flower, right? You know, it comes down to civil liberties as well.
Quite interesting.
And it's quite baffling when you think about it, really. But going back to the age as well, that's quite an interesting topic. Mm. When it is going to be 20 here, when they release the results, or the latest results from this study from Otago and Christchurch that I was talking about, they actually statistically they showed that there was very, very minimal negative effect or negative long-term effect from anyone using cannabis from the ages of 20 plus.
Sure.
They found that people using cannabis from the age of, say, 15, the risk of developing psychotic illnesses increased by 1.5 or 2%.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's quite small.
It's small. And when you look at it, when you look at that, there's a certain percentage of the population, I don't know what it is, I think off the top of my head, it might have been 1.5% of the population has a genetic
disposition,
a predisposing genetic predisposition, sorry, to develop a psychotic illness. So obviously that 1.5% or whatever the figure was, that small, very minor percentage of the population, if that some of those members of that population do decide to use cannabis from the age of 15, then their risks are increased that they may get those psychotic illnesses or develop those psychotic illnesses from the age of 20 onwards. If they start using cannabis after 20, there's really no data to show that there is a real increase there.
Sure.
So I found that quite interesting, and it really does probably back up the government's decision to not allow cannabis use until the age of 20.
Yeah, and I believe it sets almost a bad example, because obviously we see the drinking age is 18. That's almost setting an example that alcohol may be safer, looking at a blank slate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that's
you did right.
It's same. I hadn't thought of it that way. I think the alcohol industry has its own issues to deal with, and I think the general public are becoming more and more aware of the risks associated with alcohol. I think those of us that have researched the two substances in our own time and done a fair bit of research in it can say that I would say personally I believe that cannabis is safer than alcohol. Mm. You're not going to die from overconsumption. For starters, then the violence. Well,
It'd be interesting to get a group of, say, nurses, frontline medical nurses, and police in the same room, and ask them, do you see more social, economical, more social, more health issues arising from alcohol or cannabis? And
yeah,
I mean, I could guess what their answer would be.
Yeah, I think so too. So it's a great point that you make, Adam, that, perhaps we are giving a mixed message, but perhaps down the track that might be about adjusting alcohol laws or whatever. But I think...
Yeah, good point.
I think with cannabis rollout, I think the main thing is those of us that want to achieve it, the main thing is that we push for responsible integration into society. And I think if we have data that suggests after 20, the brain... doesn't seem to suffer the same potential, even albeit small, but the same potential risks. Why not roll out an age like 20?
Yeah, man, totally agree. There is obviously in somewhere like Colorado, it's the same thing there. From the age of 20, consumers are allowed to go in and buy cannabis from a dispensary, but if you hold a medical license, then 18 and 19-year-olds with that license are allowed to go into that same dispensary, go over to the medical section and purchase products at 18 or 19. So
that's interesting.
Obviously there's a little bit of leeway there.
Yeah. I think that becomes a sort of risk and reward sort of issue, doesn't it? Because sometimes an ailment can be greatly assisted by using cannabis. Although some people may argue that point, I think anybody that's sat with a cancer cancer patient and seen how cannabis can assist them. We know that it's effective.
On that thought, the problem is right now there's just not a lot of hard evidence and data to argue that, you know, these people in their late teens with certain ailments can really benefit from using medical cannabis because it's been illegal for so long.
Yes, at the clinical trials.
I mean, in 10 years' time, a lot of it's anecdotal now at the moment. Obviously, there is, places like Oregon and California and Colorado, it's been legal for a while now. There is more evidence starting to come out of there. Those of us that work in the industry, we hear daily anecdotal evidence of someone that has used medical cannabis products off the illicit market to treat certain ailments. And, you know, I mean, some of the stories that you hear are just quite mind-blowing. And it's, it's just so frustrating when you see the issues that some of these patients have to go through just to source their medical product. Conventional Western medicine may not be working for them, but this plant-based medicine is.
So I think
the future's exciting for them.
I think for younger people, I think having a little bit of leeway, as you say earlier, I think it's probably important because some of those people, the issue is their life better without the cannabis or with it? And if their life is considerably better with it, then unfortunately we've got to make some leeway.
Well, how do you tell the parents of a 7-year-old kid that they're not allowed to use, say, a CBD product that has, there's very, very limited side effects off CBD proven, but those same parents can get access to epilepsy medicine through their doctor that's basically killing the child with side effects, and I've seen it. You know, it's quite sad, really.
I think the World Health Organization has just released a review on CBD particularly, and I think they classified it as to be completely non-psychoactive from their studies and without significant side effects. So that's quite a nice development by a global body to come out and recognise like that.
Yeah, well, you guys over in Australia, your laws are going to be amended February 1st.
Yep.
You can buy CBD over the counter. Is that correct?
I'm not certain on that. Do you know?
Yeah, so the goal is February 1st. So that's moving towards buying, I believe, a month's worth
of CBD-based
CBD,
product.
Yep, which is 3 milligrams a day. Is that right?
3 milligrams?
Three milligrams a day. Yeah. I wouldn't think so. Maybe
Yeah, 3 milligrams seems relatively low to me.
Yeah. Okay.
They've set a baseline there, and they're approaching that. So, because last I'd heard the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, were reviewing it. I hadn't heard the results of that review.
I don't believe it's finalised.
That's really good news, though. It's good news for obviously for Australian patients and the industry, but it's good news for us too because once Australia does something like that, then we will follow, just as we did with the hemp seed as well. You guys made the hemp seed legal for sale for food probably about a year before we did, so we followed that one.
Beautiful. Very nice. No, and it's good to see that the two neighbouring countries can sort of watch on. We know that we've got similar cultures. We have our own unique cultures, but we do have vast similarities as well. So it's good to see that when one country can implement something, we can sort of have a reasonable idea of how it will correlate to our own society when we implement it.
Yeah. Normally New Zealand traditionally was the guinea pig. They would send things, so, for example, FPOS was rolled out here in New Zealand first of all to see how that would look. Back in the early 90s before the rest of the world tried it. But unfortunately, when it comes to cannabis, it's the opposite. But Yeah, it's been quite fascinating watching the Australian industry unfold as well. And it's allowed me just to gain a lot of insight into how I believe that the New Zealand industry will develop.
Yeah, very cool. Just want to touch on something that we discussed a few, maybe 10 minutes ago. You mentioned about smoking and people being anti-smoking. I think for listeners that are trying to get an education on cannabis and perhaps don't know a great deal about it, can we just explain vaporizing and explain that if people can buy raw flower, it doesn't mean they have to smoke it?
Yeah, well, I guess traditionally Go Public have known or have known cannabis to be, rolled into a joint or put into a bong and smoked. These days there's so many more options without going down the extracts road, without getting into that topic, just purely vaporizing. I guess it's, heating, from my understanding, it's heating raw flower to a point where the probably not the best person to explain it, but the cannabinoids are turned into a vapor. I guess it's much like standing in a shower and inhaling steam, which is just a water vapor. So it's a lot easier on the lungs, and it seems to be a very effective way of getting your cannabinoids for medical users.
Yeah, so I think that's just something that people need to know out there, that, you know, that's probably more the way that the governments will be pushing. They're just by saying that you can consume raw flower, they're not trying to push you towards smoking it. They're trying to push you towards a healthier option. And there are countries in the world that use cannabis as a smoking alternative. So they use it as a way to get people off tobacco due to the lower number of carcinogens that come from it.
Yeah. And I guess with the vaporizer, being able to control heat settings as well, and have a little bit more control over what exactly what you're ingesting. Basically, the cannabinoids will vaporize at different temperatures. I don't have too much experience with the vaporizer, so I don't really know too much about it, to be honest. But
it is fascinating, though. Brad, that's just about our time up, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and we're very grateful that we've got our first Kiwi guest on, and we're happy that it was you, mate. And we really appreciate you taking the time out to have a chat and help educate our listeners, man.
Hey, more than welcome, and it was awesome chatting to you guys. I just want to say a shout out to the ASX Medicinal Cannabis Investors Group, Jason, Jared, and everyone else on it. That was really my introduction into the Australian industry, in particular the publicly listed companies that were really the first to develop out in Australia. It gave me really good insight into how industry does develop. Sometimes they're probably not for the best, but, you know, the once you get all these corporates and stuff out the way, then maybe the really genuine people coming into the industry that are in there for the right reasons, not purely for money, are able to really forge the path and really help to develop the industry. So,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
And we second that sentiment to the ASX Medicinal Investors Group, because they've been supporters of ours as well, and they're great guys. So, yeah, thank you guys also. And they actually put us in touch with you, so that's a nice link. So,
oh, did they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so thank you very much for that, Brad. Really appreciate your time, mate.
Yes.
And we hope to have a chat with you down the track a little bit too, mate.
Yeah, or maybe we can get a bit more into the stuff I really enjoy talking about, which is the plant itself. So maybe once we get this recreational referendum over the line, touch wood, we can come back and just talk straight plants. So
that sounds great. That yep. sounds really cool, man.
Awesome.
Appreciate that, bud. We're going to love you and leave you. Thank you very much, Brad.
Peace out. See you, boys.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Canter. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Canter strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.